Welcome to the world of Culture Pop with Steve Mason and Sue Kowinski. Culture,
comedy, movies, TV, tech, authors, trends,
pop.
This is the Culture Pop Podcast.
Hi again, everybody, and welcome to the Culture Pop Podcast. I'm Steve Mason along with Sue Kowinski. And Sue, one of the shows that we are obsessed with is Succession.
Yes.
And our guest today is part of that Emmy and Golden Globe winning cast. He's also appeared in 13 Broadway productions, including Ragtime, for which he was nominated for the Tony Award for Best Lead Actor in a Musical. His other stage credits include 12 Angry Men and The Heidi Chronicles. And he's film, television, Prince of the City, Single White Female, Safe, on and on. His current project, again, is Succession, which has just wrapped up season two. Peter Friedman joins us. Peter, thanks so much for coming on. How are you?
I'm great. I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
So we start with Succession because we are just wrapped up in this show, and we just saw the wins at the Emmy Awards. How did you get part of this show?
Really? It was an audition for a casting director named Doug Abel, and joining it has been one of the luckiest things that's ever happened to me. This is a great train to be on. I'm very glad to be here. We made the pilot several years ago, and then I think I was just a character in that who could come back. And by the time they decided, HBO decided to go ahead with it as a project, they made me a regular. So I got this wonderful deal.
You know? When you first read the script, did you immediately see the potential?
I knew it was unlike anything I'd ever read before. It was nasty. In fact, when I saw the pilot on film finally, I thought, is it the world that's gotten nastier, or have they taken some of the nasty stuff out? Because it seemed normal to me by that point. But it was rough.
So, you know, your character, Frank Vernon, how, you know, what is the backstory with you and Logan? I mean, how did you become have a working relationship with him?
Sue, I'd have to watch the pilot. I think at this big dinner, is it a Thanksgiving? No, it's his birthday dinner. That's his birthday dinner. There are 95 of us sitting around the table, and I stand up and I give a toast and I say, I walked into his business 34 years ago as an accountant, and I never left. I think he goes something like that. And you know as much as I know, because, you know, what I see from the popularity of the show, and I'm sure it happens to all series, that the people who watch fill in the blanks and create their imagined connections. And in the third week of the first season, HBO sent out an electronic press kit gang to talk to us, and I knew, you know, I've got very little. I'm on the periphery of the tapestry, and they would ask me a question just like you did. Tell us about Frank, and I go, I don't know. Tell me about Frank, And even now, two seasons in, I'm going, I could be a good guy. I could be a bad guy. I could have some girlfriend in Italy. I may not. I have no idea. It's all what people have said about me, which doesn't necessarily have to be true.
Well, as an actor, then, do you have to create a backstory for yourself, or do you just take what's on the page? How does that work?
I think in this case, with a series that's written as we speak, I'd be foolish to create a backstory, because they could call the lie to it at any moment, and I'd have to erase my little backstory that nobody's seen but me.
So everybody in the show is what I kind of want to say, like, deliciously duplicitous.
Yeah.
And is there now, who do you trust the most, and who do you trust the least?
You're talking about characters?
Character-wise.
Yes. Not writer. Character, I trust Jeremy's character.
You do?
I think he comes in truth, sure.
Even after he blew it up at the end.
It makes total sense.
The truth is that my father is a malignant presence, a bully and a liar. And he was fully personally aware of these events for many years, and made efforts to hide and cover up.
I don't know why, but I can be rooting for him. In the whole first season, I seem to have been on his side to begin with. So I don't have any problem feeling fatherly towards him almost.
Succession makes it look really hard and no fun to be rich. Do you think that's true?
Yes, I found that to be true, Steve.
me too, Peter. Not too. Easy.
Yeah. Oh man, it's a drag.
I know it's a drag, but we persevere. You know, really, I don't know what's the matter with them, but yeah, it's a drag to be them. I don't know. They travel in the best of circumstances, but nobody's happy. There you go.
Did the story spring from the Rupert Murdoch family and their sort of empire?
Well, I think partly. I think Jesse would say partly too. Jesse Armstrong, the head writer, producer. I have yet to go into that deeply, though. Read a real book about that stuff. I'm just taking what I see on the page and not knowing what happens next or what they'll uncover. If they do, about my character, leaves me to be absolutely honest with whatever they give me. I mean, I hardly feel duplicitous because I'm just saying what they're saying. If next week they go, I was lying, then I go, I was duplicitous, and boy, was I convincing that last week.
You know? Sure, sure. Did you, when you were growing up, always want to be an actor?
Yeah, always. You know, plays in the den and plays in the bedroom and, you know, always doing that stuff.
What did mom and dad think?
They were okay until I went to college, and then they wanted me to have something that I could fall back on. So I chose psychology, but none of us knew that you need a PhD to make a living in psychology, and I was not going there. So I got a BA in psychology, and then, you know, and while spending all my time, you know, in the theater department, basically.
Like, what was that? Was there a definitive moment where you saw, you know, a film and said, "Oh my God, you know, this is like my favorite actor. This is my favorite movie."
No, there wasn't. There was just always playing out when I was a kid, from the very beginning. So it seemed totally natural to move towards that.
So I saw you in Ragtime, which is an unbelievable show. And I had heard Brian Stokes Mitchell was fantastic. So I'll tell you this story.
Who did you see?
I show up at this Saturday matinee and I got the understudy. He was still fantastic.
Yeah.
But I got the understudy. It's a great show. It is such a multi-layered, and your character in it plays such a significant role. Talk about sort of Ragtime and where your character fits into the massive story that it encompasses.
Well, there are three sections of American society as displayed in this show, and there's the upper class white, the Harlem Black, and the East European immigrant, which was my piece of the pie. And we're always fighting adversity. I'm literally tied to Lea Michele for the entire show with a rope around my waist and hers. And we persevere until we succeed in the end, having discovered the glories of Hollywood and filmmaking it. I guess in New Jersey, for all I know.
You were with that show for a couple of years. Did the show change from its Broadway tryout to its Broadway run?
I'm sure the writers would say massively. But at this point, after having performed the final version for 2 years, I can't remember anything, you know, what came before. But there were three workshops before the production, all happening in Toronto. And I was not in the first workshop. Someone else played Tate. And they were, fortunately for me, searching around for somebody else for the second. And that's when I came in and auditioned. And we had a sort of provisional kind of relationship with each other, the show and me, in that first one. They wanted to see how I do. And I wanted to see if this is something that was a good fit. And it was. We all agreed it was good. And so I went on to the third workshop, which was the one that was going to lead to the first Toronto to Broadway production. So it worked out great for me. You know, they were willing to take a chance on the second one that I think they would not have taken on the third workshop. You know?
No, when it comes to theater, I'm just always amazed how, you know, you do something for a couple of years and then, you know, you have like two shows a day. How do you make it fresh? How do you, you know, what is your day like, especially when you have two shows a day?
Yes. Thank you, Sue. That's the, I got that here on my list. That's the question I wanted you to ask. I had a 2-year-old and a 3-year-old at the time, who eventually became 4, I think, during the run. But first we were in Toronto for a year, and then on Broadway for a year. And that was the price of admission with producer Garth Drabinsky. If you wanted to do the show, you had to sign for 2 years. And I only had done anything for off-Broadway for 9 months before that, or no, once on Broadway for Heidi. So 2 years seemed like not what an actor wants to do. But I really wanted to do this. So I said, yeah. On a two-show day, I remember sort of making making the bed in the morning with my wife and going, I don't know when I'll see you again, little bed. It's going to be a long, long time. And it was, you know, there's a Barca lounger in the dressing room, so I would take a nap between shows. But you get there, you know, an hour or two early, you warm up your voice, you put on the beard. There's a lot of sitting into the bathtub. I'm going to do this, right? I'm really going to do this. And after a year and a half, you go, I'm going to do this, because it gets harder the longer you go on. You to stay awake and alert, and you have to invest more in, you know, preparation beforehand and getting out there and finding new veins to open in your preparation, so that once the old veins wear out, the old emotional tricks, if you will, or stories or daydreams, basically, that you tell yourself to get you to the start of a scene, you have to find different ones after a while, because their potency wears out. I think twice during the run, during the last part of the run, I lost the words to the patter song, Buffalo Nickel, photo mm-hmm. And then, you know, I'd be singing, I go, for a line. I couldn't find it, you know, it was not there. It was so certain that it was not there. You know,
Peter, I was on my way to being an actor. And I always thought, okay, I'm going to be a New York actor. That was my...
What'd you do?
I ended up coming to Los Angeles and becoming a radio talk show host. So still performing, but not as an actor. But the one thing I noticed when I was doing shows was I used to be... And I know it's not the sign of a good actor, but I used to be doing my lines while I was thinking of something else. Does that ever happen to you?
Give me an example, Steve.
I'm doing my lines and I'm thinking, God, later I got to get home and I've got to.
Wow. How did you do that?
I've got a multitasking mind, but I could be saying the words. And frankly, I probably just wasn't present to the dialogue, right? I wasn't present to it. That's why I was thinking about my shopping list at the same time. But that never happens.
No, I can't think of a time when it did. No.
I think that's probably why you became a talk show host.
Probably is. Hearing voices.
What are you thinking about now is what we want to know.
What are you thinking about?
I was thinking about the Muppet Show and Sesame Street.
Yeah. Yes. Those were, I met Jim in 1976. He was having a workshop to bring new people into the stable as puppeteers, because they had all sorts of new projects planned. The SNL run was just beginning. They planned a Broadway show. They planned this and that. So he was starting this up, and I went to their offices on 67th Street, and Jim and Frank were there for this audition for the workshop, and they put a puppet on your hand, and they asked me to do a Down East accent dialect, and I don't think I knew what that was at that point. I think I'm like 27 or something. And I said at one point, because Frank is such an amazing wit, besides an expert puppeteer, you know, I said at one point, hold on. And a few seconds later, he said, I'm still holding. I'm just not coming up with the goods.
So wait, you actually operated the, I mean, I guess that's the right term, operated the puppets?
Well, yes, I guess. I think I was more valuable to them as a voice, though. I did a fair amount of singing on the Muppet Show when I would go over for 6 weeks at a time. I think I did that about three times. But then they used me as the butt end of Snuffy up here on, you know, when Sesame Street was shooting at 81st and Broadway, which is very close to where I live. I would do that and get really, really sweaty. But it was like $50 every time you got into that costume. So for me, it was a good deal.
You've had a chance to work with some great film auteurs. I mean, the first one, Sidney Lumet, you worked with on Prince of the City. For me, you can't tell the story of the 1970s in film without Sidney Lumet, with Serpico and Dog Day Afternoon and Network. What was it like working with Sidney Lumet?
This is when I did two films with him, and the first one was Prince of the City. It was a one scene part, and I'm simply walking the lead down this row of computer equipment and recording equipment, showing where we collect our information, and you know, telling him that much, I think, when you know, for this 30-foot walk in this long room. And Sidney came up to me before we started, and you know, he knows from all kinds of parts at this point, and he knows from small one scene parts, and he goes, and he, our lead comes into the room, he asks you a question, and our story begins. And I just love that about him, that he would take each of us seriously, you know.
You also worked with Charlie Kaufman on Schenectady, New York, and that's the guy who did, I mean, he's a genius, John Malkovich, Being John Malkovich, and Adaptation. What was it like on that set?
It was... That one, I simply remember I was sewing Philip Seymour Hoffman's eyelid, I think, or eyebrow. I was stitching him up after something, and that's all I really remember from that. It was a quick little scene where we have a little dialogue about, are you hearing me? And I snap my fingers in his ear and this ear. But in terms of Charlie in that situation, I don't remember much. I most remember Philip. But over the years, we've had, you know, emails back and forth to say hi. He's come to see a play. I've read a book or seen a different movie. But I don't have any filmic stories about him for you.
So you are a working actor. How difficult is it to achieve that?
That's the second question I have on my list. Thank you, Steve.
Excellent.
So, I think it was 2 years ago. In the past 15 years, I've done a lot of nonprofit off-Broadway, new playwrights, terrific young directors, and I'm having the best time. The time that I didn't have the first, you know, 30 years or something. And I realized 2 years ago it was a year where I had as much work as I wanted, as much work of the quality that I like, that I wanted. And I said, let's see how many years that took. And it took like 46 years.
Wow.
And I wondered, and I'm not talking about money. I'm talking about these are $600 a week jobs for 12 weeks at a time. But I had four plays that I absolutely would have killed to be in. I was in. Would I, if I knew it was going to take 46 years to have that year, I have stuck around.
So, I mean, like, was there ever a point in your career where you thought, oh, I don't know if I'm going to work again?
Sue.
I know. Show business. No, I know. I'm just wondering at what point in your career, because, you know, I was a stand-up comedian for many, many years. I produce TV now. And yeah. I'm it's always like, oh God, is this going to be my last job? But sometimes you latch onto something. You latch onto a production company that just keeps on hiring you and hiring you. But I was just wondering, like, where was there ever a point? What's that?
I want a name. Give me that.
He wants that production company.
But I just wondered, was there a significant time in your career where you thought, I don't know, like if you had a lull?
If I had a lull, are you kidding? I would have a year and a half and 2 years without any works whatsoever. Mm. I live with my wife in a one bedroom penthouse apartment on the west side that my grandmother moved into the year after I was born. And now I live here. And it has a fabulous terrace, as I said. And in the decades that I've lived here and not lived here, the years that I've lived here were mostly during the time when I was struggling. And the terrace has meant, it has been a symbol of me going out and literally howling at the moon. Hmm. You know, it's been a place where I've been wailing, what's going to happen to me? What's going to happen to me? Over decades, sure. Not recently, I'm happy to say.
Yeah, right. But there were times. So what is your life? You live in New York. What has your life been during this pandemic?
Right before the lockdown, we had moved back into this apartment that I speak of from a large apartment a few blocks away that I had bought with my ex-wife. And that's now dissipated. It's gone. And a funny thing happened when I was clearing out the storage unit. I found, in order to make the move, I found a poster I had taken off the lamppost near my childhood home in Queens, Hollis, Queens, when I was 17 years old, for the Beatles' second concert at Shea.
Wow. Mm.
That was the last week that they performed as a group. Hmm. And it went on auction for $100,000. So we've been decorating.
Nice.
So are you a Mets fan?
No, I'm not a sports guy in any kind, any form. Not a little bit. I am sorry to say. I see a lot of people enjoy them.
Let me ask you this. Broadway, you know, I've got a vacation coming up, and you know, I'm doing a talk show every day during the pandemic, an ESPN talk show. And I thought, all right, so where do I want to go for vacation? And vacation is sort of a weird idea right now, this idea of getting away, because even if you try to get away, it's still there. New York is always on my list because I'm like, I want to go get some Broadway. It's not uncommon for me to fly in on a Wednesday, see Thursday, Friday, two shows on Saturday, two shows on Sunday, or a matinee on Sunday. And I don't know when that's coming back. What do you think the recovery for Broadway looks like?
Oh, my God. All they say is, you know, the Broadway League issues – you know, press releases every once in a while. I think now it's going to be June, but who knows? It's there's so many people involved in that industry, isn't there? It's crazy.
Yeah.
Really, I actually read that they said that it's coming back in May.
Wow.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Yeah.
That's the way it feels. Yeah.
Well, the way it feels is that whenever they tell you that, okay, it's going to, you know, we'll come back, you know, this date, that date. I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm living in a state of I don't trust anything. Like, am I going to feel comfortable in May, you know, exactly. to do anything?
Yeah, this whole thing about half an audience spacing out 250 people in a 500-seat house. Oh, really? Oh, gosh. It's hard to get very excited about that, you know?
Yeah. Well, last thing, do you know anything about season 3 of Succession? Have you seen any words?
No, sir, I haven't. I went to a costume fitting last week. I said, so if you're picking things for me to wear, you probably know something of where I am. They said, yes, we do. I said, tell me. They said, no, we won't.
So no clue. Is there a shooting schedule?
I know that we start November 17th at the moment.
Wow. Hmm. Well, that's exciting. That's exciting news, because we love that show and we look forward to it coming back. And hey, it's been fun. It's been fun talking to you. We really appreciate it, Peter.
Okay,
and
I appreciate it.
Be nice to have a drink out there on the terrace with you at some point.
Let me know when you're in town.
Okay, cool. Thanks, Peter. Appreciate it, man.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And there is Peter Friedman from Succession. Ah, God, that show. I'm relieved to hear that they're moving forward, that production could start in mid-November. That's a show that I just wait for. Every single episode I wait for. I don't know why it is that I love watching these nasty people so much, but they are so entertainingly nasty.
I know. It's like I feel like a drug addict. I'm like jonesing for it.
Yeah. So, Sue, tell me about your camping adventure. Sue goes camping all the time. She and her husband, Tom, who's a great guy, you guys own a Winnebago, right?
You always say it's a Winnebago. That's the only camping vehicle that you know of, I guess.
Well, what other camping vehicles are there besides a Winnebago?
Well, a Winnebago is a brand, basically. We have a travel trailer.
Okay.
And it's a wolf pup.
it's a wolf pup. Sure. I know a wolf pup. Yeah.
So it's basically it's a couple's trailer. So it sleeps two, it can sleep three, but we'll never have a third person in there because it's just too small.
You won't take me along on a trip?
I will not take, even if it was bigger, I wouldn't take it. No, I'm kidding. it's got a queen size bed. It's got a little kitchen area. It's got a stove and a microwave, and it has a little dinette, and we have a bathroom with a shower, and it's.
And how long at a time do you spend it? By the way, I know you as like Long Island Sue, as Sue who grew up in New York. I just can't picture you camping.
Were you going to say Long Island Jew?
No, I said Long Island Sue. You were. You were Long Island Sue.
I know, but I grew up in Long Island, and I went to summer camp. I went to sleepaway camp for 6 years when I was a kid. So I was a tent camper, and Tom and I actually tent camp for many years.
Oh, get out of here!
Then we had a pop up.
Yeah.
And now we have the trailer. So basically, we go to RV parks. So we went to Utah. We went to Bryce Canyon.
Nice.
And, you got hookups. So you have, electricity.
We have Wi-Fi?
We have Wi-Fi. We have a little TV in the trailer.
We have a shower.
We were able to connect to Netflix. So we were able to watch stuff.
Not for me, Sue. I'm not up for this camping business.
Not
my jam.
People say it's not their jam, but then when they come to these campsites and they see these, some people have these monstrosities. It's like ridiculous how big these are. It's kind of comical.
Yeah.
But it's beautiful inside. It's comfortable. I like sitting outside. There's a campfire. And then you take little side trips, we went hiking. Some of these places, some of the grounds, they have a pool, they have a jacuzzi, they have restaurants. Nice. Yeah, it's really cool.
Someday I'll get one of them Winnebagos and go out there to the same campsite as you.
I think you'd love it.
So, I've been cutting weight, Sue. I've been cutting weight. I've gone from 217 to 203.
Mm, and how you been doing that?
Not eating.
What do you mean you're not eating?
As it turns out, the less you eat, the less you weigh.
I don't know if that's true.
I mean, no, it's 100% true. The less you eat, the less you weigh. It's just a fact.
The less you eat. So what have you removed from your diet? Obviously you're eating, but so what have you removed?
I eat once a day.
What do you eat once a day?
We're getting food from this place called NutriFit. It's pretty healthy stuff. And I'll have some soup and a main course from them. And it amounts to, 1300 or 1400 calories a day.
So what time of the day do you always have the meal at a certain time of day? One meal?
Yes. 7 to 9 p.m. is when I eat. 7 to 9 p.m. It's kind of like intermittent fasting.
So what do you do? Do you just drink water all day? What do you do?
Drink water, drink Diet Coke, drink coffee. the fuel that gets me through the day. And then I eat that one meal at night, and that's the way it goes. Now, I will say that one night a week, we have a cheat meal. And the cheat meal this week was disgusting. It was last night. It was, and they're not a sponsor of the show, so it's okay to say. I had Grubhub go to McDonald's and pick up.
That's your cheat meal?
That's the cheat meal, yeah.
Oh, my God. What a waste of a cheat meal.
Two Big Macs, 10-piece chicken McNuggets, large fry.
You know what? You were cheated on your cheat meal. I was waiting for you to say that you had, like, you know, a steak, or you had, like, you know, unbelievable Italian food.
Nope, Big Macs. Big Macs. Last week it was love that chicken from Popeyes. Do you ever have Popeyes?
No, never.
So their spicy chicken sandwich is so good. But anyway, I am successfully cutting the weight with one cheat meal a week, although I think I'm probably done with fast food. I feel awful today. As we record this on Saturday, October the 17th. All right, so you know what time it is?
Yes, I do. Jacob.
Do you have a special guest singer today?
I do.
Okay, good. Yeah. So the podcast is proudly brought to you by Jacob and Ronnie, my good friend. And you know, accidents happen every day here in LA. Maybe you were stuck with one on the freeway today, or maybe another one earlier this week. If you or somebody you know is injured in any kind of accident, only one person to call. That is my friend, Jacob. Unlike other law firms in town where the person whose name is on the building hasn't even practiced law in years, Jacob is at the office every single day working on helping people who have reached out to him and trusted him with their cases. What makes Jacob great is that he's developed a team around him, a team that can handle the workload and enable Jacob to focus on being in front of the insurance companies and the mediators, fighting for the compensation that you deserve. Jacob has 24 years of experience. He's an expert in all types of injury situation, and he is ready to assist you and your family for a free, that's right, free consultation. Call Jacob, 844-24-JACOB. That's 844-24-JACOB. 844-24-JACOB. Jacob, or Sue, who is our guest vocalist this week?
This is my goddaughter, Morel Lindquist.
Excellent.
Okay, she's 16 years old, and here we go.
Accident or injury, call Jacob and Ronnie, call Jacob.
Hey, that is really good. Yeah. That's your goddaughter?
She is.
She's excellent. Make sure to pass that along to her. She was fantastic. The highlight of the entire show. All right. That is it for the Culture Pop podcast. Thank you very much for listening. We appreciate you being out there. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. And Sue, we will talk to you next week.
See you, Steve.
Be sure to subscribe, rate, and review. We'll see you next week for an all-new episode of Culture Pop.